My name is Monty Cox. Teach at Harding, which means I've spent the last 21 years with mostly 18 to 22-year-olds most days. And it's that generation that I'm talking about. You probably know already that the fastest growing group when it comes to a religious cohort in America is that group of people that claim no religious affiliation. There's a lot of talk these days about the growth of the nuns. Don't picture Little Women from the Roman Catholic Church in habits. The nuns, as in N-O-N-E-S. A couple months ago, NPR did a whole week-long series on losing our religion, so-called the growth of the nuns. They were actually reporting the results of a major research study by the Pew Foundation. The Pew Research Center was studying these folks, and they called their report. You can go to their website, download it yourself. Be warned, it's about 85 pages long if you print the whole thing out. But they talked about nuns on the rise and gave statistics like these, that 1 in 5 adults have no religious affiliation. So if you did a national poll today, 20% of all Americans would say, when asked the question, what is your religious affiliation, they would answer none, 20%. That 37% of those 20% would say that they are spiritual but not religious, borrowing from the mantra of Alcoholics Anonymous. The founders of Alcoholics Anonymous said, we are going to be an organization that is intentionally spiritual but not religious. That expression has made its way into the popular culture, and a lot of people claim that is their religious affiliation, but they are usually folded into the 20% of all Americans who say they have no religious affiliation. Two-thirds of the nuns, that 20%, two-thirds of them say they believe in God. They just don't participate in the life of any particular church. It's one-third of adults under 30 who have no affiliation. So 20% of all Americans, but 32% of those under 30. Obviously, a larger number. How many of you have read the book You Lost Me by David Kahneman? Can I see a show of hands? Probably be a helpful thing to read if any of you are sitting here today concerned about 18 to 29-year-olds who seem to be divested from the life of your church. Maybe they've quit coming altogether. Maybe they're just hanging on by a thread. His research shows that of people who are now 18 to 29 years old who self-report that they went to church on a regular basis growing up. So we're clear about who we're talking about. 18 to 29-year-olds right now who said they had a regular habit of church attendance when they were growing up, 43% of them say they no longer attend. Our own Flavel Yakeley, a native Oklahoman, and just down the hall from me, published the results of his long research in 2012, just last year, a study that was based on almost 5,000 kids who were members of Churches of Christ as teenagers between 1997 and the year 2006. And as he tracked those churches with the help of the church leaders where those teens attended, tracked those teens, he found that 58.2% of them would still say that they are members of Churches of Christ. That doesn't necessarily mean that they attend, but he's assuming that they do. That 21.1% of them have joined some other religious group, maybe a community church, maybe a Baptist church, maybe some other evangelical group of some kind. But 20.7% have no religious affiliation whatsoever. In other words, if you were paying attention at the beginning, the numbers among us in Churches of Christ are exactly the same as the national average. About 20% would claim no religious affiliation. But it raises the question, what in the world is going on? I think it was around 1999 when I saw the movie The Village. Can I ask a show of hands again? How many of you have seen the movie The Village? Good, because I'm going to ruin it for the rest of you. I'm assuming that you're not going to rush out and rent this, because if you do, you'll already know the twist on the movie. M. Night Shyamalan directs scary movies, and ordinarily, I'm not a fan of scary movies. I just don't like to be scared. So my children must have still lived at home when they rented this, back when you still rented things. They rented this, and I watched the movie The Village. Quaint 19th century setting called Covington Woods, where people have withdrawn into this quaint village to protect their children, raise them speaking Elizabethan or King James English. They dress in the dress of 19th century folk. They never leave the clearing in the woods called Covington Woods. No one ever visits them because, turns out, you find later it's protected by a huge fence. around the perimeter of this national park called Covington Woods. They know that there are people that live in towns, but they refer to those people as those we don't speak of. They refuse to go to the towns because the towns are dangerous, violent, immoral places. They're so determined to honor the pact they made with each other when they established Covington Woods and not visit the towns that some of their own children die of diseases that were easily prevented had they gone to the towns and retrieved medicine that could have cured them. But they don't go. In fact, the movie opens with a funeral scene of a teenager being buried. Teenager that could have been saved had they gone to the towns, interacted with those we don't speak of, and gotten the right medicine. Well, it's a long story, but to keep people within the confines of the village, surrounded by a perimeter with torches at night, boys man these outposts, guard towers, watching in particular for a monster that roams Covington Woods, a monster who wears a bright red cape and has antlers that look like the antlers of a moose, makes these mournful sounds and scares people into their houses, into the cellars where they lock them and hide from this frightful monster. On occasion, he'll take a domesticated animal and skin it and leave it on the doorstep just to frighten people. Well, it happens that one of the members of the village, who's actually not all right in the head, stabs the fiancé of an elder's daughter. Seems like trouble always begins with the daughter of one of the elders, right? And the elder can't stand to watch his daughter grieve so over what is sure to be the death of her fiancé. And so he's going to reveal to her the secret. He takes her just outside the perimeter of Covington Woods, takes her into a shed and shows her the bright red cape and the antlers and reveals to her the secret that, in fact, there is no monster. It's one of the elders. They take turns at night dressing up as the monster, making the mournful sounds to frighten people into staying within Covington Woods. Now, part of the irony of this plot line is that his daughter is mostly blind. All she can see is color. Because red is the color of the monster, red is a forbidden color in Covington Woods. We don't want to get confused between something safe and something that's monstrous. So he shows her the truth about the monster, tells her how to get out of Covington Woods, make her way to the towns where she'll encounter those that we don't speak of and find the medicine that will cure her fiancé. Off she goes. It's a long story, but she reaches this wall. And as she's climbing over the wall, back in Covington Woods, you see her parents in the cellar opening old photo albums where you see pictures of them dressed like they belong in the 60s or 70s, 1960s or 70s. It's the first time in the movie that you realize this is not a 19th century village. It's a late 20th century village. They have reconstructed in deliberate isolation a 19th century setting in order to protect their children from those we don't speak of, from all these evil influences from the outside. She climbs the wall, remarkable for a mostly blind girl, and then you see a piece of pavement. A Land Rover from the National Park Service drives by, picks up the girl, takes her to a ranger station. She gets the medicine, makes the hike back into Covington Woods, administers the medicine that saves her fiancé, leaving the elders to wonder what the future holds now that the secret is out. When I watched that movie about 14 years ago, I knew I was watching a metaphor of my life in Churches of Christ these first 53 years, where we had a very clear perimeter. We were very sure about who was us and who was them. We made it clear that if you ever left Covington Woods, if you ever left us and stepped over the line and joined them, those we don't speak of, although we spoke of them often, but more often than not, in the church I grew up in, at least, I don't know about where you grew up, but in the church I grew up, a church I still love, a church that supported me while I was in Africa years ago. In that church, when I was growing up, at least, when we spoke of those we don't speak of, but we spoke of them in terms that made it clear that they were us. They were not us. They were them. And you should stay away from them. In some ways, we put guard towers and torches to guard the perimeter to make sure nobody left. And in some ways, I would say there were even monsters that would moan and groan and scare you so that you would know that you would pay a heavy price if you ever dared step over the boundary and out of the clearing and beyond Covington Woods. But now, I'm watching as a steady stream of people, many of them young people, walk right up to the boundary, right up to the torches, look up at the guard tower and smile. Look at the monster in the red cape with the antler-looking headset and kind of smile as he moans at them louder, trying to scare them into staying in. And then I watch as they walk right past the boundary and leave us, leaving the elders and the leaders to wonder what the future holds. What in the world is going on? I believe the spiritual landscape has changed dramatically in our culture the last 25 years. We're not talking about trendiness in this session today or the two this afternoon. We're talking about shifts in the tectonic plates underneath our culture that present a number of challenges. Many of them come from without, that is, from beyond our fellowship, and some of them come from within. We'll begin with challenges from without. I should tell you right now, if you're that obsessive compulsive person who feels compelled to take notes on everything a speaker says, you're going to be so frustrated in the next 25 minutes because it's going to go too fast and there are too many big words these next few minutes. I'll just make it easy for you. Write down this email address. It's not a website. It's an email address, mcox@harding.edu. mcox@harding.edu. You send me an email, I'd be happy to send you the whole PowerPoint presentation. I put it in one. All three presentations are in one PowerPoint presentation. In case you don't want to take notes, you just want to listen. What are those challenges from without? I begin here. The influence of what some would call postmodern views of meaning and truth, which undermine the authority of Scripture and raise serious doubts about religious exclusivism in any form, including the exclusive claims of Christ, and render evangelism and missions politically incorrect. As in, wait a second, I hear in your persuasive tone that you think I need to be what you are. And in fact, if I don't believe what you believe, that my soul might be in jeopardy, you got to be kidding me. In a world of postmodern truth, where there is no truth, there is only perception, or where it may be true for you but not true for me, where truth has been redefined to mean not that which corresponds to the way things are, but truth now means that which is helpful. It's helpful, not necessarily true in any kind of absolute sense. Now, before I go on, let me quickly add that I always get nervous when I hear a preacher who's going to stand up and talk about postmodernism, because I'm almost always certain it's going to be bad. He's going to bash it, as if postmodernism is only evil. You need to know that to say something is postmodern simply means it's not modern. And more than we know, the modern worldview, with its scientific commitments, has so influenced us that we find ourselves trying to argue people into faith using science to do it, instead of using Scripture to do it. We even use science to prove that the Bible must be reliable. Do you think we may have that backwards? It's the modern influence among us, not biblical influence. So I spend a lot more time these days, not today, but in my classes, talking about not modern apologetics and not really postmodern apologetics, but talking about biblical apologetics, which, by the way, are much more relational, but that's for a different workshop. So we'll unpack that more a little bit later. The influence of pluralism in North American society, which exposes our constituency, however you define our constituency, to spiritual alternatives to Christian faith. When you were growing up in Podunk, Texas, sorry, my friends from Northridge and Mount Pleasant, but wherever you were growing up, you probably never met a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Muslim. But now your grown children are auditing companies with Hindus and Muslims and some even dabbling in forms of Buddhism. We're exposed to the alternatives out there. Anybody ever heard of that book, Eat, Pray, Love, or seen the movie? It's a brilliant book. This is her second book. Didn't read the first one. Her first one apparently was successful enough that she got an advance to write another one. With that advance, she decided to travel. She'd gone through an ugly divorce Liz Gilbert had. It's actually a non-fiction book about her spiritual journey. So for the first 4 months of her sabbatical, in preparation for writing this book, she goes to Italy, where she mostly eats. Then she goes to India, where she mostly meditates or prays. Then she goes to Indonesia, in particular the island of Bali, where she finds love again. Eat, Italy. Pray, India. Love, Indonesia. Italy, India, Indonesia. Eat, pray, love. 4 months in each place. Brilliant book. that obviously resonates with a lot of people, because since it was published in 2006, it's been on the best seller list for nonfiction paperback for 5 years, from 2006 to 2011. Then the movie didn't do so well, probably because the movie was too faithful to the book. It was too much about this woman, Julia Roberts' spiritual quest. Anybody seen The Life of Pi? How many of you have seen The Life of Pi? I'm not suggesting that you do. It's a beautiful movie, cinematographically. It's pretty to look at, but intense. I mean, the guy, this kid named Pi, is on a boat with a Bengal tiger for the whole movie. Or is he? I'm not going to ruin this one for you. The last 5 minutes, you learn that maybe he's not on a boat with a Bengal tiger. Which story do you prefer? The pluralism of Pi, who is both a Hindu, a Christian, and a Muslim all at the same time, is a fascinating story. And that is still on the New York Times bestseller list, the book is. It has also led to the demise of the Constantinian view of the relationship between church and state, in which Christianity enjoyed favored status as the predominant religion in America. The shift has led many of those who identify themselves as Christians feeling like a minority in their own homeland. Does that describe any of you? Do you feel like the Christian faith is the one that gets most abused, most battered in pluralistic America anymore? By Constantinian, yes, I mean that Constantine, the first so-called Christian emperor in the 4th century A.D., who didn't necessarily say he was a Christian until the end of his life, but in effect, he underwrote the Christian agenda when he legalized Christianity. And there are those, even today, who think that's what America ought to do. America ought to be more supportive of the Christian agenda. But America will no longer be supportive, not the government, will no longer be supportive of the Christian agenda. Not anymore. We no longer enjoy that favored status. In fact, for the first time in our history, less than 50% of all Americans self-identify as Protestant. It's 48% now, as of a few months ago. First time in American history. Now, you may get all bent out of shape about that, but I, for one, am not too troubled by this change in demographics. If you go back far enough in our history to the pre-Jerry Falwell days, then you experience a kind of aloofness among churches of Christ when it comes to all matters political. But when the moral majority came through town, we felt like that was our bandwagon and we felt obligated to hop on it. And this is probably the most controversial thing I'll say all day. I say this with a pure heart, love in my heart for all of you. But I think one of the greatest threats to our participation in the life of the kingdom is the uncritical merger between church and state that we are accepting as Christians. Go back and listen to that on the tape and see if you figure out what that means. I know if you go back far enough in our spiritual heritage to the first century, our first century forebears would certainly say, oh, you're troubled about the pluralism around you? You're concerned that the government doesn't seem to support your cause? Read 1 Peter. Welcome to our world. Learn something. The radical individualism of our time may not make anybody's list as something that threatens Christian commitment, but it does. The radical individualism of our culture and the concomitant, that just means it goes along with, the concomitant mistrust of institutionalized religion. Do you know anybody that doesn't trust organized religion and says so? Apparently about 32% of all young people 30 years old and under don't. Which to some extent drives the proliferation of new church movements like Simple Church and Emerging Church, community churches and the like, and their offspring, along with the proliferation of parachurch organizations that attempt to do what their founders believe institutional churches have failed to do. That's too much to talk about, but just trust me on this one. There's a lot of individualism among us. Always has been since our pioneer days. It's growing deeper, not less. It's getting stronger to the point where young people say, you know, I should decide for myself what's true and real. When the biblical response to that is, sorry, you're too dumb to figure that out. And so am I. You're too jaded by sin to decide for yourself what's right and wrong. You're dependent on a God who speaks and reveals to you what is truth and what is not. And yes, you have something to do with processing what God has revealed. But we have also bought the individualism as if it is always and only a virtue, when sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. Another challenge from without, especially the last 10 years, has been this reinvigorated skepticism, thanks to astute representatives like Sam Harris, who wrote a book, The End of Faith, shorter version, The Letter to a Christian Nation, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, names I'm assuming you've heard. And all of that is supporting this growing number of people who consider themselves none when it comes to their religious affiliation. The globalization of Christianity, which has seen the center of Christendom shift from west to the south. I have to explain my directions here. When I say west, I don't mean Arizona. I mean the western half of the world. As you know, probably for a long time, people said by the year 2000, the center of Christendom, broadly defined, will no longer be North America or Europe. It will be Africa. Guess what? In the year 2013, there are more people who self-identify as Christian, whether you agree with their definition or not. There are more people on the continent of Africa who identify themselves as Christians than any other inhabited continent in the world. It is the center. Now, what happens when the missionaries you send to places like Burkina Faso, Sarah Matheny, Tom Ritchie, I see back here, when you send missionaries to Burkina Faso, they plant churches and they empower those churches to read their Bibles, and they come out on certain points that you consider to be key in a different place than you do. Are they still us? Can we maintain fellowship with them, or have they left the boundary, crossed to the other side out of Covington Woods? The push to make churches more missional as a response to these shifts, I put here as one of the challenges. It's in some ways wishful thinking, and in some ways the jargon is too academic. Like all this jargon, it's been too academic, I know. I'll be less academic this afternoon, I promise, when I talk about what I perceive to be solutions. But missional just means we're going to have to look at North America as a mission field. We're going to have to think like missionaries, contextualize the message, not in the modern way, because that's passé. And the young people who are rejecting it, 30 years old and under, are not primarily modern. They're primarily postmodern. You're going to have to learn the language, speak it well, and contextualize the message in a biblical way that communicates to those younger folks. And that's what missional means. Again, I don't like the academic jargon, but I understand where we're going. What about challenges from within our own fellowship? One, you have to begin with the obvious decline. The decline, or at least the leveling off in numbers of members nationwide. How many of you were here 10 years ago at the Tulsa workshop? I rest my case. You see the change in numbers like everyone sees the change in numbers, and there are lots of reasons for it, I'm sure. I don't know what all the reasons are. I don't come every year myself. But it does reflect a decline nationwide in our congregations. In 2003 to 2009, according to our best expert on the subject, Flavel Yakeley, whose study published last year is called Why They Left, he said that we've experienced a 4% decline in the number of congregations and a 4.1% decline in the number of members. What do we do with that? That's one of the challenges. It's a challenge in a place like Harding University, where there is a steady decline in the number of kids who take the ACT and then report on the ACT that they are members of Churches of Christ. That number went from something like 23,000 in the early 2000s to 18,000 in the late 2000s. That means the pool of people that all of our Christian schools are recruiting from in Churches of Christ shrank by 5,000 over a decade. Significant decrease. The shift of the center or mainstream of our movement to the theological left and the aging and shrinking of those congregations associated with the theological right. You'll notice that I was careful to put air quotes around all of those loaded terms, because I certainly don't want to start an argument about who is to the right and who is to the left. I travel all over our fellowship, and some Sundays I'm in a church that looks very much like my own, and in other churches, other Sundays I'm in a congregation that looks more like the one in which I grew up, different than the one of which I'm an elder now. At least judging from what happens in the assembly, which, side note, is typically how we make that judgment. It's based on what happens in the assembly, our determination of whether or not they're orthodox, right? I like to think that Jesus' own definition of orthodoxy is different than what happens in the assembly for an hour. Not that I'm trying to undermine what we do in the assembly. I just think orthodoxy is defined differently in places like Matthew 25 than it is among us. But we have to say the center, at the very least, is moving to what we used to think of as the left, in the sense that many, if not most, of our vibrant, thriving congregations in metropolitan areas no longer identify themselves with the right. Most of those churches that are in decline or are shrinking are in rural parts of the country. Part of that is a simple demographic shift from rural to urban. And part of that is because it's those churches that identify more with the right-hand side of the theological spectrum, and their children don't. And therefore, it does not feel like home to them anymore. The shift within our churches and how we interpret the Bible. If you'd like to stop there, feel free. The rest of this is complicated and requires a lot of unpacking. But I'll go ahead and say it anyway at the risk of being overly academic. The shift I would describe as a shift from a letteristic approach to reading Scripture to a grammatical, historical, literary approach, both of which fall within the literal school of interpretation. If you ask me, do you read the Bible literally? I'm going to say, yes, I do. I hope you do too. Now ask me what I mean by that. What I mean by that is you must take into account the literary nature of a text. Genesis is not written to give you a scientific explanation of how the world began. Now, I know I'm going to sound liberal to say that. I'm trying to be faithful to what the Bible teaches. And if you were a bunch of nomads somewhere in Mesopotamia, 2,800, 2,900, 3,000 years ago, and you were given a scientific explanation of how the world began, including a precise explanation of 24-hour days and how photosynthesis works and all that stuff that people say Genesis teaches, I think you would totally not understand Genesis. But if you lived in a world that said, the earth on which we live is the product of the gods who were fighting each other, and in their anger, one cut up another into a bunch of pieces. His name was Marduk. From him came the first human beings. And that's why there's so much suffering in the world, because the creation of the world itself is a product of all this infighting between the gods, and therefore the world is bad. So, summary of ancient Mesopotamian creation myths. The world is created by multiple gods accidentally, and it's bad. That's why there's suffering. What is the message of Genesis? One God made the world. He did it on purpose. This is not a cosmic accident. And he stood back from it and said, you know what? That's good. I know it may not sound like it, but if you believe those three things about the world you inhabit, if you believe those three things about yourself and your place in the world you inhabit, that the world is created by one God who made it on purpose, and he said it's good, that will change your whole life. Genesis could change your whole life. But because of modern commitments, not biblical ones, we want to force a scientific reading on Genesis. I would say, I'm the literalist, and you're not. The shift within our churches and how we understand the authority of elders and how they should be appointed. I'm going to ask for a show of hands. You can do that at Tulsa. A show of hands. How many of you are members of congregations where the congregation identifies the elders, and the elders that are presently serving have nothing to do with the process? Can I see a show of hands? Anybody come from such a congregation? Okay. It's a growing number. I am a member of such a congregation, and we are in the process right now of identifying new elders. I say it that way on purpose, because I think that's more faithful to the way Luke describes the process in Acts. And I know you're going to tell me about at the end of Acts 14, Paul and Barnabas appointed for them elders in every church. It sounds like Paul and Barnabas did the appointing, but we'd have to unpack that too. I believe the congregations of the ancient Mediterranean world we read of in the New Testament were commissioned to identify those men among them who had the traits of shepherds. Don't, by the way, run to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 before you pore over Jesus, the model shepherd, and talk about those kinds of qualities that you should expect to find in a shepherd. Don't pass by Acts that the seven men who were chosen to diakone, that is to deacon, not a title but a job description, in Acts 6, that those men should be men who were full of the Spirit and of wisdom. I'd like to think that the men we identify as shepherds are at least first and foremost full of the Holy Spirit and of wisdom, wouldn't you? But we tend to jump over to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 to get the list of qualifications in a very modern checklist kind of way, rather than reading the Bible literally in the proper sense of a literal interpretation of the Bible. Anyway, that shift means congregations have more of a say in identifying the elders, and therefore the elders are not as free to just perpetuate themselves in their own thinking. They can't just choose men who identify with them and who fit the way they see things and eliminate those who don't, and therefore perpetuate the status quo. In many of our churches, that's not happening anymore. I recognize that that is both a product of the changes taking place among us and one of the reasons for the changes taking place among us. How about this one? The resurgence of emotion as a legitimate means of worshipful expression as a reaction to the modern emphasis on reason. You don't like it, perhaps. I'm a real left-brain guy, too. I don't care for it that much either. But I'm married to a right-brain woman who I love and admire, so I'm learning to be a more balanced guy in my own life. And when that woman worships, sometimes she cries. And sometimes she wants to lift her hands. Could she do that in your church? Or would you squelch her desire to express herself emotionally? Boy, if you do, I bet you would be really uncomfortable if King David ever walked into your church naked, dancing before the ark, and his wife back there, Michael, is embarrassed, going, "I'm so embarrassed, that's my husband behaving this way." I don't know how you read the Psalms and think that somehow emotional expressiveness is taboo. The only reason we eliminated emotional expressiveness as a legitimate means of worship among us is because we are heirs of Campbell more than we are heirs of Stone. He was more rational than he was experiential, and because we really loved all things modern. The postmodern generation feels repressed unnecessarily. Well, I said the only reason, another reason, probably the main reason for many of us, my age and older, is because we just didn't want to be Pentecostal. If you're emotionally expressive, well, look at them. They're lifting their hands. They're clapping their hands. They're just so Pentecostal. We didn't want to be Pentecostal. And listen, if you mean what I think you mean by Pentecostal, I don't want to be Pentecostal either. But neither do I want to squelch emotional expressiveness in the name of doing what is decent and orderly. Because if I do, I'm imposing a modern, rational understanding of decency and orderliness on that passage, and I'm doing that inappropriately. The widespread dissatisfaction with and the outright rejection of the sectarian spirit that many observers would say came to characterize our fellowship in the 20th century, and I'm one of them. This reaction has fueled what many have labeled an identity crisis in the churches of Christ. I love our fellowship, and I would prefer a more positive label for it. I think in many ways what's going on among us right now fits the description identity crisis. Do we know who we are as a distinct fellowship anymore? But I'd rather say that more positively, and I will in just a minute. In fact, I'll say it right now. Three responses I would offer with some disclaimers. One, I'm not in a position to predict the future. Two, I am confident that I am a part of a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Aren't you? And three, which is really 2A, that I'm a member of a fellowship known as Churches of Christ, a discernible, visible representation of the kingdom of God on earth, but not the sum total of it. And by saying so, I could get in trouble in some quarters, but I'm assuming that most of you in the room are restorationists with me, and that you and I could say together with our restoration forebears, we are trying to be like our first century forebears in many ways, but we don't think we are the sum total of the kingdom of God on earth. And therefore, I find reassurance in that line from Hebrews 12:28 that we have inherited a kingdom that cannot be shaken. With disclaimers like those in mind, may I humbly offer three responses, two of which I will speak about this afternoon. The other one I'll barely mention. Number one, we need to embrace and not fear the reorientation that's taking place among us. That's the positive rather than the negative way to say it. Some call it an identity crisis. I prefer to think of it as a reorientation, where many of us are experiencing a reorientation of our faith, a faith that was anchored earlier to the boundary issues, those things that separated us from the Baptists and the Pentecostals. That was who we were. We're learning to anchor our faith more in the person of Jesus of Nazareth than in those traditional boundaries of our fellowship, which does not mean that therefore we must jettison the things that make us as a fellowship different. It doesn't mean that. It means that we need to inhabit those boundaries differently. In case that doesn't make sense, come back at 2. And I'll spend the whole 40 minutes talking about only number 1. Number 2, we need to model thoughtful, respectful dialogue with others, imitating the inclusiveness of Jesus while upholding his exclusive claims. The inclusiveness of Jesus modeled in a conversation with a Samaritan woman, with a woman who pours this perfume on his feet in Luke 7 and wipes his feet with her hair. The inclusiveness of Jesus, who says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets to the Father except through me." Can we do that? Can we model, mimic his inclusive demeanor while upholding his exclusive claims? And if you come back at 4 o'clock for this one, I promise I'll mostly tell stories instead of do something that's been very academic thus far. Number 3, which I don't have a fourth session, so I won't talk about this one. I'll cheat and throw a little bit of this into session 3 this afternoon. We need to talk more about a Christian way of knowing that is both humble in light of what we don't know. You know we don't know everything, right? Anyone here willing to admit that you don't know everything? I've studied the Bible my whole life, and there's still things in it I don't understand. I love studying it. In fact, I love the fact that there's still things in it I don't understand. Still new treasures to discover, if I can borrow a line from Jesus himself. I love that about the Bible. But I'm free to admit that there are things I don't understand. And yet, can we also be confident in light of what we do know? That combination of humility and confidence, I find, sadly, to be quite rare among Christ's followers. Hope you'll come back at 2, and we'll talk more about that first response. We'll see you then.